It's the Bob McCowan Podcast, brought to you by Bet Rivers. Download their online casino and sportsbook app today.
It's McCowan and Shannon with the podcast for today.
How are you, Robert?
I'm doing all right. How are you?
Good. I'm not talking Raptors, okay? I am not talking Raptors.
Good.
Remember 34 points.
Early in the season when everybody was so optimistic about the Raptors. Do you remember who said they would be terrible this year?
Okay. Stop gloating.
Do you remember?
Please stop gloating.
Thank you.
Okay? I mean, you're like our old pal Grapes that used to say, let's run the tape from last week when I told you something.
Well, I did tell you that, didn't I? I told you guys they would be awful, and they are awful.
They are not very good. That's for sure. We'll talk basketball tomorrow a little more in detail. Maybe,
oh, great.
Maybe talk. Maybe we'll talk a little Sweet 16 too. How's that?
I think.
Study about Zach Edey and the boys. Something different today, Bob.
Yeah.
We sit here and every podcast that goes on about sports and on radio and television, we put athletes on a pedestal and we criticize them and we have expectations for them. But athletes are people too. And there are a couple of guys that have fascinating stories, hopeful stories. One is Dr. Jay Harrison, the former NHL player who's working on a program for the Players Association to help players and former players compete and thrive in their postseason lives and even away from the game while they play. We're going to talk to Jay Harrison. Then we're going to talk to Kelly Chase, who has a long, illustrious career in and around the game in St. Louis, Saskatchewan boy. And he's battling leukemia right now and getting through the fight really well. We're going to talk to Kelly about the battle and how he takes something like that full on, as Kelly Chase is wont to do. So it's Jay Harrison and Kelly Chase today on the McCowan Podcast.
Hi, this is Bob McCowan for BetRivers.com. Hey, if you're looking for a sports book or casino app, you should check out the BetRivers Sports and Casino app today. Play all of your favorite casino games for real money anywhere and anytime. Plus, get in the action with each sports game with hundreds of sports betting options. And get ready to feel like a VIP because you'll earn both loyalty level points and bonus store points on every real money wager you make. You must be 19 plus, available in Ontario only. Please play responsibly. If you have questions or concerns about your gambling or someone close to you, contact Connex Ontario at 1-866-531-2600 or speak to an advisor free of charge. BetRivers.com.
Welcome back to the podcast. McCowan and Shannon in Toronto, joined by Dr. Jay Harrison, who is leading the NHL Players Association First Line Leadership and Education Program. And Jay, it's a nice title, but in layman's terms, what the heck does it mean to be part of the first line for the NHLPA?
100%. Thank you. Thanks for having me, guys. First line means, or to be first line ready, as we say, as an NHLPA member, is to be aware of mental health, how to identify optimal and declining mental health. It's having an awareness of the resources that you have pertaining to mental health in your network. And it's having the confidence to be able to engage your teammates, peers, friends, and family in sometimes difficult conversations pertaining to mental health. It's about being a mental health leader, whether it's in your dressing room, in your home, or in your community. And it's taking an active role in your own mental health.
Do you deal only with retired players?
So we do first line. We're currently offering and doing that for our current players, our NHLPA members. This program was a product coming out of the pandemic and recognizing the need to be more proactive with our players in supporting their mental health and well-being. We did some research with our players to better understand the role the NHLPA could play for them. And one of the things that we did uncover naturally, and as a former player, I certainly could attest to this, was that players talk to players if a player ever had an issue, one of the first people they usually tell in their circle is a teammate. And what we said collectively as a group, those of us at the PA who are working with these issues and supporting our players this way, is what can we do to enhance these conversations for our players to maximize and ensure they get to the resources they need in a timely way? And that's ultimately how we came to First Line, is recognizing that we had an opportunity to empower our players to have these conversations and to be active participants in their own health and well-being.
How do these relationships start? Do you contact the players, or are they responsible for contacting you?
So in our initial launch and engagement with First Line, we relied very heavily on our personal relationships. We have some other programming and relationships with the players, I cross players quite a bit within my role at the PA, whether it be around their professional development outside the game, or even just as a peer-to-peer support in their network. So across our fall tour, our leadership with Marty Walsh and Ron Hainsey are very supportive and engaged in this particular part of our athletes' life, and recognize that the Players Association isn't just for labor-related issues, but also for enhancing and supporting and optimizing the lives of our members. We educate all the players on the offering and what it is and what it's designed to do. And sure enough, there is usually within every club a handful of players who are interested in this, whether they have personal experiences, whether themselves or relatives, or they just want to be a more effective teammate and bring more to those around them. They have that natural desire to be leaders on and off the ice. We tend to be able to form those relationships quite organically. That leads to an opportunity to take a group of players, usually a small group of players who are interested in it, through the training program.
So Jay, I'm curious. In the time that you were in Toronto and in Raleigh and in Winnipeg, would there have been a stigma about being coming forward and talking about these things? And has that changed from that period of time? Not that you're old, man, but has that changed to what happens now in 2024?
I think there is certainly change, but very much still stigma is still present. Certainly, we're moving in a more progressive direction in understanding stigma and the role it plays. But yes, I would say that there is still a great deal of stigma, not just in sports, but societally. We still have, you know, whether it's self-stigma, you know, labeling ourselves and even, you know, judging ourselves, to the fear and the implications of coming forward. Often people will ask me, well, why are professional athletes so hesitant to come forward with mental health, their mental health issues? And when you sit and think about it, it's actually quite purposeful. The idea of attending to my mental health or identifying the fact that I may be experiencing a challenge represents an opportunity threat, right? I've worked so hard and sacrificed my whole life to get here. I can sacrifice a little bit more, even if it means a little bit of my mental well-being. So there is a lot of fear that this particular aspect of bringing this kind of attention to oneself bring unnecessary judgment, criticism, or opportunity loss. So that's part of what we're unpacking with First Line as well. And by normalizing mental health, and we framed First Line, it's very important that we frame this training as a leadership exercise, because we want to empower the culture collectively as a group. If we're going to change stigma, it's going to be through the players. And that's the impact it's going to have on our game.
It would seem to me that a player who's retired would be more likely to address these issues. Is that true?
Or at least close to retirement.
Right.
Well, certainly as life changes begin to emerge, like as players get older in their careers, there's a lot of life changes that happen as well. You know, players, you know, become, you know, married or in, you know, significant relationships, have children. Their scope, their perspective of the world changes, their perspective of themselves changes, their professional identity changes as well. I think you address a good point, Bob, when you talk about what might happen and some of the challenges players experience as they move through that transition process. You're dealing with a significant loss of identity, the potential for experiencing the perceptions of isolation. Certainly there's financial changes and burdens and a number of resources that may or may not be available that could maybe exacerbate some underlying conditions that maybe didn't get addressed or circumstances when they were players. So retirement and working with our players through transition is critically important. You know, we work in tandem with the Alumni Association and offer our players care and support across that period of transition. And it's transition doesn't last a month or a week or 6 weeks and you've transitioned. I usually say transition takes at least 3 years for a player to fully, you know, repurpose and identify themselves with a new career direction and a new path and purpose with their life that fully integrates their experience as an athlete. So we're very mindful of the sensitivity of the changing environment in an athlete's life as they go through that in retirement, which is likely why we see some of those issues crop up just because of that uncertainty and instability in that time of life. It's very stressful.
Jay, you know, it's fascinating because Bob and I talked about in the opening that we often forget that athletes are human too. Because they're on the, we put them on a pedestal and we expect them to perform at a high level all the time. What's the correlation between finding a future and the amount of money you make? How much of a factor does that become in knowing that I'm comfortable, I'm going to have, I'm going to be fine and my family's going to be fine if my family stays around, by the way. And what am I going to do with the rest of my life? How much do you discuss that?
Well, it certainly is a factor to consider. Financial independence and wealth and the ability to accrue wealth is but one aspect of one's well-being. And we know that every person puts different value or incentivizes financial independence. Some of our players, despite being very wealthy and professional athletes in general, don't really equate career success to making money. And while they may have made money, their true value that they get out of what they do comes from the fraternity, comes from the ability to be a leader. It comes from, you know, other areas that that work may actually provide them with value. So part of it is aligning our career values and recognizing what it was about being a professional athlete that really incentivized us. I call that our take-home pay, right? And then aligning us for careers where we can start to explore other particular industries, professions, roles, opportunities that pay in similar ways. And that's, it's always not just dollars and cents. You know, we all have very unique vocational incentives, as we call them, that ultimately give us value for the work we put in every day.
How does this differ from the Players Assistance Program?
So the Players Assistance Program is designed to be a confidential and clinical resource for players that are requiring or looking to get treatment, clinical treatment, in a way that is confidential and protected. So we would call that a very downstream resource. Certainly encourage players to utilize that resource. It is a very effective one that they can get competent, comprehensive care in a private, confidential way and ultimately be in charge of their health and well-being. We like to see things like we're doing with the NHLPA, like First Line and our Unlimit, which is our career development program. These sit upstream as more proactive opportunities to enhance and develop our players and give them the resources to meet some of the challenges they'll experience through their career, whether it is as an NHL player or beyond, and also arm them with the knowledge and awareness of those resources should they experience a crisis or concerning moment that, you know, temporarily exceeds their ability to cope and manage their current experience, to know that they have those resources in a relationship to the NHLPA to get care for those in a timely way.
Most NHL players are not well educated. They may have high school diplomas, maybe, but very, very few are university educated, are prepared mentally for what comes next. Do you encourage athletes either during their career or later to be more educated to get a higher degree if possible?
It's certainly the right path for some of our players. It's not the right path for all players. And I think actually, if you look at the correlation of, you know, multi-millionaires and successful businesses, there's not a strong correlation, I'm pretty sure, to the post-secondary performance. So there certainly are players who value education and see it as a very viable pathway. Like, for example, for myself, as part of my transition, you know, a longer career trajectory in academia was important in order to be able to do the work I wanted to do. A lot of our players, you know, are interested in starting businesses or being involved in businesses, which really require a different set of education. So one of the things that we've been able to attend to is and recognize is that not all of our players need 4-year degree education. So what we've begun to develop and offer with institutions like Stanford, the University of British Columbia, Temple University, is what we call professional development and executive education certificates for our players that are exclusively available to them. So players can get certificates in business fundamentals, leadership, education, urban planning and development for those who are oriented more towards a real estate perspective, to start to give them some of the skills that can really apply to those fields when they're out there using their network as professional athletes, that they can start to make a meaningful contribution to those places while they're still playing. And again, that activity of acquiring new skills and competence has a huge benefit to your health and well-being, and even enhances your performance as a professional athlete. So we encourage all of our athletes to see those resources as not life after hockey, but rather, you know, life with hockey and life through hockey, which can have a huge benefit, not only once they retire, but also as players in the NHL.
So I like your analysis of being proactive rather than reactive. So I'm a 10-year veteran. I can see the end coming to my career. Talk me through how I go through this. Do I pick up the phone and say, "Hey Jay, when are you coming through my town?" And what's the next step?
Yeah. So again, we're very proactive in not only addressing these, but being in front of our players and educating them about these resources. So we have small meeting groups. We talk about it on our fall tour. It's a big component. Players are very, very active in this. So we're constantly getting the word out there and reminding players that this is a benefit of membership. We encourage you all to use it regularly in any way you want. So there's a number of different pathways that our players, you know, come to use our unlimited resources or get along with First Line. You know, our DPRs are on the front lines. Our provisional player reps are very effective. I'm out on the front lines, and we have other individuals in our organizations, that, you know, provide that outreach and act as a touch point. And then it really becomes a one-on-one process for our players because they're all coming from different places. Some players have university degrees. Some players have high school. Some players have already started businesses and have a very, you know, sophisticated portfolio of activities that they're doing. Others haven't even asked the question of what I might like to do. We have to be ready to respond effectively to each player's unique situation. So we've really developed a one-on-one approach that meets the client or the player where they're at, right, in a way to bring them value. So, you know, we do things like behavioral assessment to align them for their transferable skills and strengths. We have career strategists that we utilize who are very effective at helping players develop networks and building meaningful relationships that could create opportunities. And then we have our executive education that we have for our players as well to help them get educated and skilled and have confidence to go into some of these spaces.
This may be an unfair question, and I'm sorry if it is, but how could you have helped Chris Simon, if at all?
Well, that's a very difficult question. I think how we look at the challenges of someone like Chris, who experienced a lot of challenges throughout his life and career, it would be my hope that through the work that we're doing, anyone who may be as in a distress the way Chris has experienced may be able to utilize and identify and advocate for their own health in a proactive way in the future. I'm not sure if there's anything we could have done. I'm not sure that's particularly helpful in Chris's situation. I certainly know and believe that it's a loss of life and makes you feel like a deflated balloon on the floor with what could have done. So we focus on the future and use stories like Chris, former teammates of mine, like Wade, who had a profound impact on me personally, was a dear friend, and others we've lost to be our inspiration. And what we're trying to do is to prevent the next and keep our work focused on the future, helping one athlete at a time.
You know, I've been around the game a long time too, and there was always a complaint that the Players Association stopped looking after players once they stopped playing, and that, you know, and with the arrival of Glenn Healy, the alumni has really picked up that slack. But there is a role for the Players Association after retirement, isn't there?
Yeah, there certainly is, and I think that's been well recognized by the current players. So for example, the player assistance program you talked about is available to our players for 5 years beyond their last year in the league. Certainly our transition resources, our Unlimited program is available to our players for a number of years beyond their playing days, because we recognize that period of transition can be very difficult and doesn't happen in a linear fashion. and can sometimes take time to evolve and develop. I also work closely hand in hand with Glenn and the Alumni Association to get that continuity of care for players and ensure that they get the resources that they need, regardless of their situation and where they're currently serviced and being a member, whether they're an active player or a former player. We do everything we can to ensure that that player receives the care and resources that they need in the most responsible way.
Before we let you go, I'm just curious. I remember you as a player. I didn't know you well, but
Shock. Not many do.
Hey, listen, you played about 365 more games in the NHL than Bob and me, so that's okay.
Right.
How did you get to this? I mean, how and why are you in the place you are right now as a person? Because I think that's part of this story too, isn't it?
It is. And it wasn't a linear path. I found a great deal of strength when I played through education. The game wore on me very hard. As I say, I didn't live my best life through the game. But I did find an enormous amount of strength through education and expanding who I was outside the game while I played. And lo and behold, I found that when I realized that my game kind of took off and I started to fulfill the potential I thought I always had as a player. But the real gift of that was the mentorship that I received from others, within the game, but outside, whether it be, team doctors or, psychologists and people who I was able to network with that saw that I had a potential outside of being a hockey player. And they watered that seed and I allowed it to grow. And my mission really now is about ensuring that no athlete sacrifices the best version of themselves just to be an athlete, that we can live our best life through the game. The game does not have to hold your mental health hostage to play. And you can live a great, consistent life and optimize your fullest potential through the game. And this game is but one aspect of the expression of who you are. This does not reflect your entire purpose of why you're here. And why you're here does not end when you finish playing. So I wake up. So that means there's more to help. So that's been my journey to this point.
Well, I'll tell you what, Jay, it's a fascinating approach to the game. It's probably long overdue. And it's something that reminds us all in and around the game. And I think for hockey fans that the guys that play are real people too. And they need help as anyone.
That is a great point. And, sometimes I like to say people say, oh, you work with professional athletes. That must be really cool. I say, I don't work with Spider-Man. I work with Peter Parker. And just a reminder, for every Spider-Man, there's a Peter Parker underneath dealing with real-life issues. Mary Jane, Aunt May, the death of Uncle Ben. These are all real-life issues that can impact how Spider-Man does his job, too.
Right.
Cheers, Jay. Thank you.
Good luck.
Thanks, gentlemen. Thank you so much. Take good care.
Okay, bye-bye. You're
Dr. Jay Harrison of the NHL Players Association First Line Program. Bob and I will be back with Kelly Chase, another story inside the game of hockey, on the McCowan Podcast after this. Welcome back to the podcast. McCowan and Shannon in Toronto. Kelly Chase in St. Louis, Missouri. And as we talked about in the opening, Kelly was diagnosed with leukemia last summer, Kelly, earlier this year. When did it happen?
November is kind of when they found out that that's exactly what it was that was getting me. And so this last 6 months have been a little bit of a whirlwind.
So as a curiosity, were you feeling sluggish? How was this affecting you prior to diagnosis?
Yeah, it was funny. It was more of little things that you think have happened to you because of hockey, like an ankle infection and I can't get rid of it. And they go, well, you probably have gout. And then a tooth that was an implant that I couldn't get rid of the infection in my mouth. And they were like, well, it won't tighten up and it feels loose. And now, we're going to have to take and pull it out and put this, cadaver bone up in there and let it heal. So you have more bone in your mouth and in your jawline and just little things like that continually kind of seemed like they were standing in my way of being, having a good quality of life. And I went to a really smart doctor by the name of Trish Herford, who does a lot with infectious disease and blood work. And she basically said, I don't like the way your blood works and looks, and sent me to Siteman's Cancer Institute.
Must have scared the hell out of you, I would think, right?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because you ask, like, what am I going there for? What the hell am I going there for? She's like, I don't like the way your blood looks. I just need you to go just do this, you know? And of course, I'd gone in and had the surgery done on my mouth. And she was on a plane and said, don't go to have this surgery done. You know, and listening like us hockey players normally do, I was like, look, what do you mean? I'm already here with the surgeon. So the surgeon's like, what's she talking about? So I'm asking her to call me, and she can't because she's on a plane. And she, by the time she had landed, boy, my phone had lit up and she was all over me about getting the surgery done because the bleeding could have been continual and so on and so forth. And she said, well, are you bleeding lots? And I said, clearly you don't know me. I'm not much of a bleeder. And I kind of laughed about it and just, you know, she said, listen, I'm serious. You get in there. So I ended up in the hospital at Siteman's and got blood work done. An hour and a half later, had three doctors come in a room and tell me, hey, you know, cancel everything for the next 6 months because you have an aggressive type of leukemia, and we're going to need to do some work here.
And when that, you mean aggressive type of treatment, what has that treatment been like?
Well, it's the first time you go in, John, it's like, it's fight, like fighting. You don't mind fighting. You just want to see the size of the guy. And I really didn't know how big this guy was or what hand he fought with or whether he could take a punch. And believe me, leukemia is all of those things. He's tough. He fights with both hands and he can take a punch. So I was in a situation where the first 34 days, I think I spent 34 days in here. The first 10 days I had an infection that had grown, and when it was turned in from a little cyst into a pear shaped infection that I had to have out of me. And then it was all these little things that made me sick that I didn't know what the hell was going on for 10 days. And then you come to the realization that it's the first time in your life where you need to really rely on people, where I didn't, you know, think my way out of the situation or fight my way out of the situation or work my way out of the situation. I had to rely on other people. I'm not good at that. And that was what made me realize, holy smokes, this is something that, you know, but I've never asked for the prognosis. I've never asked for the odds. I've never asked for the analytics on it. And I've never looked it up on the internet because I just feel like I'm going to win.
Is that a hockey player's mentality you're talking about, Kelly?
I don't know. I was asked that earlier today. And I said, you know, I don't know if it is. I can't get in the mind of other people that are in that hospital, and I see them very sick and I feel horrible because I feel like I'm not that person. I realize I'm in the hospital with them and I'm a couple doors down, but I'm not that person. And I go, geez, I wonder how they got to that point. But then again, you know, like, I've been taking a lot of grief from my ex-teammates because I had a Peloton in my room, and I rode the Peloton 24 days in a row. The first time I was in, I rode it 9 days in a row. The second time I was in, and then tore my tendon on my patella tendon off my kneecap. And the guys are like, that's more than you worked out when you played. And here you are with this Peloton in the room, you know. But I just did it more for the sanity of just being active and not being married to my bed. So is that a hockey player mentality? I don't know. But I know that my doctor gave a great talk to the fellowship and the nurses and just said, you have to leave him alone. Like, I was on a trial drug for the first two rounds of my chemo. And it was aggressive, as you mentioned, and it took a lot out of you. But he said, yo, you'll be sleeping under that bike day three. I said, we'll see. So I'd made a bet. I bet my doctor $1 that I was going to do 100 pushups a day, 100 sit-ups a day. I was going to walk between 7 to 10 miles, and I was going to ride the bike for 30 to 45 minutes a day. So, and I said, but when my numbers get to where they're supposed to be, where you think they're safe, you tell me what they are right now, then I want out of here. I want to go home. I don't want to be in here. And he said, okay. So at that point, he didn't show up. He was at a seminar for 2 days after I had hit those numbers. I had 2,800 sit-ups and 2,800 push-ups and done my 7 to 10 miles and rode the Peloton And now my numbers are where they're supposed to be, but my doctor's not here. I'm seeing another doctor that's coming in to see me in the mornings. And I have a nervous breakdown. Like, I just have a breakdown. I'm like, I'm in the shower, I'm crying, I've got, you know, I'm hyperventilating. So I do what any normal person would do. I call Tony Twist. And I say, Twister, get me out of here. I can't take this. Get me out of here right now. And he's calming me down and saying, hey, no, whatever. And then the next question is, have you seen the scene in The Town where Ben Affleck asks that Remy, is like, hey, I'm going to ask you to do some stuff tonight. We're never going to talk about it again. And we're going to hurt some people. And the guy says, whose car are we taking? Well, that was kind of like this. I said to Twister, I need out of here. I mean, I'm going nuts. And, you know, I've got these numbers and the doctor isn't showing up. And all he said to me is, he asked me if I was all right. I said, I'm all right. He said, you hooked up to anything? I said, nope. He said, I'll be there in 25 minutes. So that's it, that, you know, and then the story's growing a lot too, because I stopped him 15 minutes later and he came in and got me the next day, but he did take all my stuff out and he did bring one of his service trucks from his windshield repair company with a hoist on it for the bike. And he did tell me that, hey, we're escaping you out of here, which he had everything lined up. I just needed the doctor to come in, and my doctor showed up, who is a great guy. And he realized that we were actually leaving, and he just was mortified. He's like, dude, you don't have the flu. You have leukemia. Like, you hockey players, what's wrong with you? You don't just leave. Like, you don't leave. So what's the matter with you? And he's just giving it to me. They discharged me later that afternoon, and my family was able to do it. And Twister walked out, but he did say to Twister, he said, I'm going to discharge him today. Are you not okay with that? And Twister said, oh, I knew he was leaving today. I didn't know how we were getting his bike out of here without anybody seeing it, but I knew he was leaving. And so, you know, you have very few of those guys that are in your life where you know that they're going to be the 3 a.m. guys. When you call them, they're going to answer and they're going to take care of you. And Twister definitely stepped up and pointed out the window and said, there's my service truck. The flashers are on, the pylons are around it. Go downstairs, down the service elevator, go across by the coffee shop, go up the escalator, get in my truck and sit in my truck. I'll be right there with this bike. I said, well, the doctor isn't here yet, but that's how he is. And he's the best. Yeah. So maybe not the best play. I wouldn't recommend, I guess, if you're trying to heal from this stuff, but Dr. Twist was going to take me out of there.
So you're still on chemo right now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you have any idea how long you'll be doing that?
Yeah. Yeah. Bob, I have one session. It's in remission, which we know from after my third round, which I'm grateful for. And I did my fourth round. It knocked the hell out of me, you know, from a tired standpoint, nausea, which I never had in the other rounds. And then I have one more round left, which I'll go in. We're having a great event up here for Siteman's up in St. Louis during our president's meeting of our alumni association. And then I'll go in 2 days later on the 7th, and I'll do chemo for 5 days. And then that'll be the end of it. And then on the 10th of May, I'll go in and get a bone biopsy done.
Right.
And they'll go in and make sure that it's still in remission. I don't have any splashes of the leukemia or the cancer in me, which is what the test showed the last time. So we pray for that and just keep grinding.
Yeah.
I'm curious, Kelly. You have been first of all, the St. Louis hockey community is an amazing group of people, period. But how has this affected your family? How has that happened? And how much do you worry about yourself versus worrying about your family?
Well, it was tough because the first time that I had saw that when it was happening, my oldest son, who's done college, was living in Phoenix, and he came home and he could work from, you know, remotely. So he came home to St. Louis, and really he took charge of basically the family. Like, he, you know, from the, who could be coming and going from the hospital to, you know, handling people that were trying to come in to see me. And I've been very fortunate to have that to, you know, he sort of took charge. And then my other two, one's playing at ASU in Arizona, one's playing up in Nipawin in Saskatchewan. And so they had a break, all of them at the same time prior to Christmas. So they walked in on me. And I think it was probably the first time where I have this saying where I say, you know, if I'm going to be the leader of the house, you got to read the paper. You got to act like you're in control. And I've always sort of said, like when we've had things I think that are affect our family, you have to, you know, steady the ship. And I've always talked about how you read the paper, because if I was to look at the two pilots and I was playing cards in the card game on the charter, and we hit turbulence and they just keep reading the paper, I just go back to the card game. Okay. They're just reading the paper. They're fine. Everything's fine. But if all of a sudden they start reaching for masks and extra seat belts, you know, I get a little bit nervous. And so I think it's the first time that my boys have probably seen me where they're like, I don't know if he's reading the paper, you know, like I wasn't healthy, and I was trying to act like I was in control of the situation. And it's the first time, like I said, in my life, I'm not good at it, but I needed help.
One of the things that always amazes me is the support of the hockey community. And you're always active on social media. So, but you know, every fourth day when somebody came to town, somebody came to St. Louis, there was always a picture of another superstar or another coach sitting with Kelly Chase at the hospital. It's truly amazing, isn't it?
It's unbelievable. Like, John, you have no idea. Like, if you, and it would be no different with you. Like, if you were to find yourself in this situation, just how many people, there was times where I would read a text message from somebody and go, there's no way that guy's texting me because I was such an ass on the ice to that guy. There's no way that guy just sent me that. And I think my guys are playing a trick on me, you know, but you could hear, like, all of a sudden you'd hear Oshie's voice in the hallway coming down the hall. I'm looking for, and I could hear him, you know, and I'm sitting watching a game or watching TV or watching something. And I'm like, oh, and then, you know, and like just all of the guys that came, Kirk Muller, the scouts that would show up, Jimmy McKenzie. One day it was for sure the toughest room in the hospital. I had Berube and Twist, Jimmy McKenzie, myself, and Grimson flying into town. And I said it like I was laughing at all of them. And Stu has been in a situation before with me where I was in a hospital, and I fought Stu like 11 times. Okay. So when you wake up and that ugly mug is sitting beside the bed, you just look at him. I said, you better get me now because you're 0-11 and this is your best chance you're going to get, buddy. And he just laughs about it. And, you know, I'm going to kiss you right on the lips and there's nothing you can do about it. And you realize that you've got this great brotherhood of people. Rick Tocchet. I've texted Rick Tocchet, you know, every second day for months, and, you know, his team and I never played with Tock, but we're friends. And I never played with Cam Neely, but he's the night before the game having dinner with me at the hospital. And we've been friends since we were young, but it's just the brotherhood that no one can take away from you. It's pretty special.
It is. Yep.
Well, you've been great for the game too. I was telling Bob before we went on about your relationship with John Cooper.
Yeah.
And the role that you played, not that Cooper's played in your life, but the role that you played in Cooper's life.
Yeah.
It's a small circle, boy. It's a small circle.
It sure is. He's a special guy too, because Coop will be good at anything, but it's funny. Like, he could talk to, I say this all the time about Coop. It's a skill that he has about how he communicates. Like, he could talk to the Pope, a priest, a prostitute, and a pimp all in the same day. They'd all like him. And he talked them into whatever he wanted to too, but they like, the crazy thing about the guy is they'd all like him. He'd be like, he's just got this charisma about him that, and so I think when he had his law degree and was starting to practice and we needed a coach and junior team and we were starting, and I talked him into coming. I was like, first I was joking with him. I said, you're just fixing parking tickets anyway. That's not really a practice. Like, that's not law. That's just fixing parking tickets. And then I just kept bothering him. And then finally I said, Coop, come on. Like, you're a coach. You're not a lawyer. But he'd been an unreal lawyer. But he, you know.
Hey, before we let you go, I gotta ask you one hockey question.
Yeah, yeah.
What do you think of Matt Rempe?
I like Matt Rempe. I wish I could tutor him. I sound like a lot of the guys in the league because I think he could fight a little bit more, like a little smarter and be way more effective and not expose himself at all. And I think he's gonna become a better player because of it, you know? And look, If you have anybody 6 foot eight, that you're seeing this, you guys, more and more, is that toughness is a commodity. We won in 19 in St. Louis because we bullied everyone out of the playoffs. So you can tell me till you're blue in the face about how skilled the team is and what they do in the regular season. And it doesn't mean one thing to me, because I every year see the teams that that want to pay the price a little bit more, and especially getting the monkey off the back in St. Louis, that type of player. And not just, I'm going to say he may not play all of the games, but he's a guy that's going to get Panarin. He's going to get some of these players that are small. He's going to get them through January, February, and March to get them into April. There's less guys running at those little guys than there's ever been. And they're having success on the ice, and their bodies are going to be in way better shape in April and May because he's on the team. And he might not be in the lineup thinking, oh, they can't even use him in the playoffs. What a waste. Well, guess what? There's 3 months there where he saved a whole bunch of guys from having a bunch of soreness that they don't have. And that's why they're where they are.
It's great to hear you talk hockey, man.
It's great talking hockey. It's great seeing you guys, and love watching.
Good luck.
One more plug for the event. One more plug for the event on April 5th.
Yeah, it'll be great. I've got Sean Payton, Garth Brooks, and Tony Granato coaching one team. So that's a good mix of guys. I got Coach Quenneville finally out of the woods. So I got Joel, who should be coaching in the NHL. I got Joel, and I got Hully on another bench, so that ought to be entertaining.
Well, they won't talk to each other, so that's okay. Yeah, so
Hully will be bitching. And then we've got Dierks Bentley and Trevor Rosen from Old Dominion playing on one team. Coulier and Dave Coulier and DB Sweeney playing on another team. And then, of course, we've got all the guys that the St. Louis fans love to hate, Chelios, Belfour, Roenick, all playing on a team. For Team Granato, and then the St. Louis guys, that Shanahan, Brendan, and Little Nelly Emerson, Courtneau, like all of those guys come back and that are playing. We have most of the guys that can still move playing on a team, and it's going to be great.
Only a guy like you who's going through the issues you're going through would think about raising awareness and raising money for cancer. Congratulations, Kelly, and I wish you good health. And I hope the hair comes back. You know,
the hair is starting to grow, John. I actually had to shave here, and I had to cut my fingernails. It's the first time in 6 months I had to shave and cut my fingernails. It's a bonus.
You had the best hair, man. It's the best hair.
It's going to come back in a Jerry curl. Just watch.
That's Kelly Chase fighting the fight. Good for you, Kelly. Thanks again, man.
Thanks, guys.
Bob and I'll be back after this. Well, Bob, every time we think we're doing something different, and Harrison and Chase were different than we normally talk about, it kind of throws you for a little loop. Those guys are trying to help other athletes, and in addition to Kelly's situation, trying to help himself. It truly is amazing to me.
Well, what I've been going through, and I'm not going to compare it in any way, but I certainly have a better appreciation of what Kelly has been through. And I have a daughter, as you know, who has had cancer. Yep. And she's in remission for the third time. Wow. And she still goes to the hospital every week and has 8 hours of treatment once a week. You know, and to live like that is, it's difficult.
That's hard. By the way, after listening to Kelly with all his exercise regime, I'm coming over and making sure you do 100 push-ups and 100 sit-ups a day, pal.
Good luck.
Yeah. Don't lock the door on me. Something a little different today. We got a bonus show, Bob.
Right. First of many bonus shows.
Well, yeah, first of many. That's right. We're going to do a show with Jeff Rimmer, who is retiring after almost 50 years in the broadcast industry. Right now, the voice of the Columbus Blue Jackets. And we're going to talk to Jeff about his career, his time in and around the Baltimore Orioles, the Washington Capitals, the Florida Panthers, how he tolerates Doug McClain, and a few other things. So that's a bonus show later today, folks. Give it a listen and be aware, and hopefully you have time to enjoy it.
Right. We hope so.
And tomorrow we will talk Toronto Raptors, despite Bob's protestations.
Well, I don't know what we're going to talk about, but I'm sure the guys that we have on will tell us how great the Raptors are. And I, of course, we'll sit here and say, you're out of your mind.
Here's the deal, Bob. 44 points they lost by. 44. All right.
Well, we'll talk with the boys. Any points, I think.
Yeah. We'll talk Rimmer later today in a bonus show. Basketball tomorrow. For McCowan, Shannon, thanks for listening or watching the McCowan Podcast.
It's the Bob McCowan Podcast, brought to you by Bet Rivers. Download their online casino and sportsbook app today.